Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Monday, so this is an archive show. First published as a newspaper column sometime in the last 10 years. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on July 7th of 2024 under the headline Bridge Patent Trolls Found Match in Condi McCullough. It's part one of a two-part series on Condi McCullough and his Oregon bridges. Here we go. Condi McCullough had a problem. Actually, let's restate that. The Iowa Highway Department, which McCullough worked for at that time, this was in 1914, had a problem. What McCullough had was an opportunity. His solution to Iowa's problem would several years later enable him to basically write his own ticket, and the name that he would write on that ticket in the destination space would be Oregon. But at the time, that happy day was several years in the future and was far from certain. The problem that the highway department had, and it was depending on McCullough to solve for them, was a big one, and its success was far from assured. There was big money involved. The problem's name was Daniel Luton, and he was the founder and president of the National Bridge Company. Luton was a patent troll, possibly America's first. The National Bridge Company was one of a handful of kind of startup construction outfits that had sprung into being after about 1890, and that's when people started regularly traveling on driven wheels for the first time. Wheels at this time meant bicycles. Automobiles wouldn't be a factor until 15 to 20 years later. But driven wheels, not drawn wheels. Obviously, a horse can cope with much worse road conditions than a bicycle can. So Oregonians and other Americans started using bicycles, and they quickly found that the roads that worked okay for old Bessie and maybe dragging the barouche behind her were not great for bikes. In fact, the early wheelmen, riding the old big wheel penny farthing models, it could be a matter of life and death for them. A bad road surface could lead to a header crash over the handlebars with a strong possibility of a broken neck. If you've ever wondered why the hipsters never brought back penny farthing bicycles, the ones with the huge wheel that you perch up on top of, think about what happens when you slam on the brakes on a downhill run on one of those. Nobody would write a liability insurance policy for manufacture of something so dangerous. Anyway, back to our story. As counties and states started spending public money on fixing their old mud bog wagon roads, they naturally wanted to replace fords and ferries with bridges. But most 1890s counties didn't have much engineering expertise in-house, so they would entertain bids from contractors, including nationally active bridge companies like Luton's, which sold their services and designs like life insurance policies, courthouse door to courthouse door, promising whatever it took to make a sale. These companies typically just installed whatever bridge they had patent rights on or expertise in, whether it fit the spot or not. Many of the bridges they built lasted only a year or two before footings washed out or surfaces failed because of a design that didn't work with the local geography. Others required so much additional bracing and reinforcing to make them work that the adaptations, like huge wing walls to prevent flood washouts and massive slugs of concrete to anchor thrust arches in sandy soil, that kind of thing, ended up costing more than the bridge. At least one bridge company successfully sold the same bridge to two adjacent counties. The bridge crossed the county line, so the company billed each county the full price of the bridge. They also typically overcharged because county leaders didn't really know what a bridge should cost. By 1914, when the state of Iowa turned to Condi McCullough for help, this problem was well on its way to solution. The state had started helping the counties out with free bridge plans and consultation services, and that made it a lot harder for a bridge salesman to parachute into the county seat and sell a bunch of farmer leaders a line of garbage. Plus, everybody in government by then knew somebody who knew somebody who'd been burned. No, the problem that McCullough faced was that the owner of one of those bridge companies, when that would of course be our friend Luton, had discovered that he could make more money shaking counties and states down with dubious patent infringement lawsuits than he could make making bridges. Old Mr. Luton was playing a pretty long game. He'd started it around 1900 by throwing spaghetti at the wall of the patent office, using slight modifications to common bridge architecture elements to claim patent protection on them. One or two of these were legitimate, the majority were not. Not all of Luton's dubious patent filings stuck, but some of them did, and as a result, basically every reinforced concrete arch bridge in the world suddenly became legally an infringement on his patent. So Luton lawyered up and started shaking the governments down. His typical royalty fee demand was 10% of construction budget, so you can see how this could add up to a pretty nice income for him. Everyone knew what he was doing. The problem was it would cost a ton of money to fight him, because the burden of proof was not on him. He had a patent. Anyone who wanted to argue with him could go ahead and spend huge amounts of money fighting him in court, or just settle the matter for a lot less money by just paying his ransom. And that was how it went at first. If you were, like, say, a Dubuque County Commissioner, you didn't have the resources, and you certainly didn't have the expertise, to do the research and pay the lawyers to fight a claim for a few tens of thousands of dollars on your three or four quote-unquote infringing bridges. But that changed when states like Iowa got involved and hired competent bridge engineers like Condi McCullough. Knowing their potential exposure to Luton's shakedowns ran far into the future and involved millions of dollars, the Highway Department pulled McCullough off his other duties and tasked him with taking Luton down. 3 years later, in 1918, a judge was looking over a 600-page report that McCullough and his staff had produced, along with 15 bridge models and hundreds of other exhibits. They laid the case out very clearly and in ways that a layman could clearly grasp. Luton's patents had been issued for concepts that were already well known and published and in the public domain. The judge banged his gavel and invalidated almost all of Luton's patents. McCullough's handling of the patent troll had brought him nationwide fame in highway engineering circles. He now had some opportunities for advancement that he probably had not had before. If he'd wanted to, he probably could have landed a job anywhere in the country, or of course stayed in Iowa. He chose to move to Oregon. In 1916, he packed up his family, he and his wife Marie Rodden McCullough and their infant son John, the first of their five children, and settled in Corvallis, taking a professorship at Oregon State University, which was then known as Oregon Agricultural College. So, the big question, why Oregon? Well, it cannot possibly be a coincidence that Samuel Lancaster's famous and legendary Columbia Highway 100 was nearing completion at that time. The highway was all over the national media, in postcards and magazine spreads, and it seems very likely that McCullough, looking around for places where he could put his skills and aesthetic sensibilities to best use, settled on the state that had just demonstrated that it shared his design values by hiring Lancaster to build the Columbia River Scenic Highway. Condi McCullough spent the next 3 years teaching at OAC. Meanwhile, he wasn't the only one drawing inspiration from Lancaster's masterpiece, the Columbia River Scenic Highway. It was a popular destination for excursions, so thousands of people came to see and drive or ride on it, and then returned home to wherever they lived and compared local efforts unfavorably with it. This includes folks who actually lived in Oregon as opposed to farther afield. The same bridge company hucksters who McCullough had helped run out of Iowa were still closing sales and building rickety garbage spans over rivers and creeks in Oregon at this time. They'd been run out of Iowa, but Oregon hadn't stepped it up. Public pressure started to build for the state to get involved, just like Iowa had. And in 1917, they did. They created a powerful highway commission and started it off with a $6 million endowment. The following year, State Representatives Loyal Graham and W.B. Dennis created the nation's first gasoline tax to provide continuing funding. And the year after that, they took the very obvious step of reaching out to OAC's rising star bridge architect and offering him the job of building its bridges for it. McCullough doesn't seem to have hesitated. He promptly deputized his entire senior class of OAC engineering students and moved to Salem to start the most productive phase of his career. The phase that would end with his name associated with five spectacular bridges on the Oregon Coast Highway, along with dozens of smaller spans, all sharing a distinctive design architecture that screams Oregon Bridge at a glance, as well as an engineering excellence that's kept almost all of them in continuing service to this day, nearly a century later. We'll talk about Condi McCullough's work as Oregon's bridge architecture czar throughout the 1920s and 1930s in the next one of these podcast episodes, which will be coming up either tomorrow or Monday, depending on when this drops. See you then. Key sources in this story have included works by Robert Hadlow and Dwight Smith. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I do hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. By the way, if you enjoy the Offbeat Oregon podcast, you should definitely be subscribing to the Welcome to Oregon podcast that Marcus Axford started doing a couple of years ago. It's getting really good. It was always really good, but it's getting even better. And he's covered a couple of things along the way that I thought, gosh, I ought to do a story about that. I'll wait a little while, though. I don't want to step on his outro. Anyway, check him out wherever you get your podcasts. Wherever you got this podcast, you'll also be able to find his. Also, while I'm talking about local producers of interest, there's a guy named Peter Dibble who does local documentaries on YouTube. They're about 30 minutes long, and he did one recently that just came up on my YouTube feed called Race Across the Continent, about America's first cross-country auto race in Curve-Oldsmobiles. I haven't watched it yet, but it's next on my list, and you probably will enjoy it too. I just thought I'd call your attention to it just in case you weren't aware. All right, that's enough of that. Let's finish up the outro here. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Offbeat Oregon History episodes come out once per weekday, usually around 6 a.m., so it won't be long before the next episode is on your device and ready for you to queue up. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.